Good morning, folks. My name is Martin Shields. I'm a certified financial planner and wealth manager at Boucher Financial Group, and I'm sitting in for my colleague, Steve Boucher, who's deserving a morning off. So it's great to be here with you to answer any questions you may have regarding your financial planning or investment management concerns. And I encourage you to call in with those questions. You can reach me at 800-825-5949. That's 800-825-5949. So I hope you're doing well on this absolutely spectacular morning here. Whether you're just getting a cup of coffee or out driving or maybe out in the boat early or whatever you're doing, I hope that you're enjoying this start to this Sunday morning. And, you know, hopefully you have some nice plans to go out and do something. I'm actually going to be alone this Sunday. My wife and two daughters are heading up to Burlington. My daughter's a junior, soon to be senior at Saratoga High School, and they're looking at UVM. So they're going to be meeting with the track coach tomorrow. So and my son's off at a birthday party, so I have the whole day to myself to just enjoy. Got to figure out what I want to do. There's so many options. So I hope that you are got some nice plans and going to be doing some fun stuff on this great day. But we're here to talk about finances, whether it be investment management or financial planning. I encourage you to call in with any questions. And you can reach me at 800-825-5949. And we're going to go right to the phone lines. We have Dave from Hartford. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Mark. Nice to hear you. I tell you, you do a great job. Every time I hear you, you do a wonderful job on the radio.
Well, I appreciate that. It's always good to hear from our listeners. What can I help you with?
Yeah, if I could ask your opinion of the ETF, it's called the S&P 500 High Dividend ETF, SPYD.
SPYD?
Yeah, it invests in the 80 highest dividend paying stocks in the S&P 500.
Yeah. So, it's the U.S. Dividend Aristocrat. You know, there's probably four or five different ETFs that are kind of focused on, focused on dividend growth and companies that have really good balance sheets and they consistently grow their dividends. This is one of them. So, you know, the great thing with this is, you know, it's not just focused on companies with high dividends, because if you look at just the high dividends, what you're usually going to get is a lot of risk, right? There's a reason a company has to pay a high dividend, and that usually tends to mean they're a little risky and they may not continue to pay that dividend. This ETF, again, focuses on companies that grow their dividends consistently over time. And it's a great approach. So I like it as part of a diversified portfolio. I think, you know, some folks get a little bit too focused on the dividend, which, you know, the thing to remember is dividends are important as far as overall growth of a portfolio over time. But if you focus purely on just dividends, then sometimes you give up on, growth opportunities for companies that don't provide dividends, right? And they can also be good right in a portfolio. So, yeah, this is a great, if you want to get exposure to dividends, broadly diversified, and again, these companies grow their dividends over time, this is a great approach to doing that.
Now, when you look at a performance of a fund like this, you know, the year to date, the performance is different than the yield. So, than the dividend yield. So if you want to know the total performance, you have to add the dividend yield to the performance, right?
Well, in most, when you look, if you go on the website for State Street, and it should provide both a performance growth with the yield and without. I'd have to go on and check, but quite often they'll provide it with and then without the yield. I'm actually looking right now. Yeah, I'm not seeing it with the yield. So you might have to add it in. But yes, that's important, is to look at it both with and without the yield, because what they'll do is when they'll look at it with the yield, they'll assume that you reinvest those dividends back in, which is a reasonable assumption. And that's where it gets powerful, right? Is if you continue to take those dividends and you reinvest it back into the fund, the growth over time can be very significant in that regard. So, yep, you look at it both with and without, and that's going to give you a good idea overall how the performance stacks up against another ETF.
Okay, great, Mark. Thank you. You do a great job again, so I'll be listening.
You got it. Take care, Dave. No, it's a great question from Dave. I mean, again, the one thing I always say is, when we talk about diversified portfolios, having everything from dividend paying stocks to growth stocks to value stocks, small cap, mid cap, having those different components into a portfolio just really provides value over time. And, from the dividend perspective, the value of that, having a dividend fund is that those companies tend to do well in good economies and in bad economies, right? So, a lot of those companies are more your blue chip consumer-based companies. And, even when you go through some hard economic times, those companies tend to stay in there a little bit. Now, it doesn't mean they're not going to go down when the market goes down, but maybe less so than growth companies. And even while they're going down, you still have that dividend yield. And, again, really would caution investors to always look at, how are those dividends being grown over time versus just the overall yield. It's really kind of you can kind of get enticed by looking at companies with high yield, but without a doubt, there's in investing, you don't get there's no free lunch, right? So if you're getting a high yield, there's a reason for that. And as you saw with GE and any company, as that yield grows, those companies are going to struggle to pay that high yield. And really, it's a situation where they may have not have the cash on the balance sheet or have the revenue to continue to pay for that dividend yield. So always just be a little bit cautious of that. But great question. But from an investment perspective, another great week in the markets with the markets, the S&P hitting all-time highs. I talked about this yesterday on the show that, really that's driven by corporations having another great quarter for earnings. And, not only was the earnings for the second quarter good, but their forecast as they look out over the next 6 to 12 months continue to show earnings growth. And, as long as companies can do that, whether it's by increasing revenue and managing cost, you're going to see the market do well. Again, would always kind of put it out there that we could see some volatility. The months of August, September, and October, from a historical perspective, can be quite volatile. So just be aware of that. Doesn't mean that you need to really change anything, but I think sometimes people get lulled into thinking that the market only goes up after we've had some really, really the last year, you think about it, had a little bit of volatility last fall, but in general, we haven't had much. And have to see with this Delta variant. As I said in the show yesterday, it's I hope everybody is trying to be a little bit more aware with this variant. It's definitely a situation even when people are vaccinated, they could be catching it. But definitely when you look at the stats, those people who are vaccinated, their impact from symptoms and hospitalization is it's much less. So hopefully that you get educated on being vaccinated and that's what you're out doing. And that's how we're going to get back to normal, is you think about where we stand now versus a year ago, and it's because of the vaccine. And hopefully everybody will be vaccinated. And I'm of the mindset that we're going to be dealing with COVID for the rest of our life. So a year from now, this probably is not going to go away. There's going to be a different variant out there. And from an economic perspective, that's we need to kind of move beyond COVID, and certainly in many different fields like hospitality and small businesses to be able to open back up. So that's when we look at it from an economic perspective, there is the two main risks out there. Is one is the Delta variant or us having to kind of pull back from opening up type of process. And then the other we've talked about is inflation. And that's really, inflation is driven by both demand for goods and services and commodities, but it's also a supply issue too, right? And We've had some supply issues globally because of COVID and shipping and everything. So we'll have to see how those two play out. But some of the more recent inflation data actually says that things are okay, right? And we knew there was going to be a spike in inflation data, but the real question was it going to be sustained? Was that inflation just a kind of a one-time blip because of the increase of demand for as the economy was opening, or was it going to be more sustained? And one area where we'll have to see how it plays out is the labor markets, right? Which this is we are definitely in. There's two markets we're in right now, right? We're in a seller's market for real estate. That is absolutely the case if you've been out trying to buy or sell in the real estate market, certainly here in the capital region, but I think across the US. And we're in a market that favors labor. That is absolutely the case. Whether it be blue collar or white collar, you talk to small business owners or even large corporations, lots of job openings out there, and they're having to pay up for workers. And we really have not had this type of environment since the 1990s. If you remember during the tech boom, there was during that time period, labor was in the driver's seat. They were able to negotiate salaries and really find opportunities to switch jobs if they needed to. Actually, I was just reading in the Wall Street Journal a really interesting article. Not something I'm going to recommend anybody doing, but it was about people because they're working remotely, holding down two jobs. So they had a job at company A, working remotely, and they felt as though they could handle another job, and they took a job with company B at the same time, also working remotely. It seemed like a lot of these folks in this article, at least, were programmers. So I guess if you're in that field and you can do programming at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or 1 o'clock in the morning, and get your job done, then I guess they were able to get away with it. At least a few of the people they interviewed were talking about the stress of doing that, trying to hold down two jobs. But it's definitely again, it's a labor market, and what that means with that is if it's more and more the case that wages continue to rise, that can be more problematic for inflation. And it's we have not had any real inflation since the 80s, right? So there's a real generation, probably myself included, as far as from a business perspective, that has not seen any real inflation. And what I will tell you as a student of economics is you really don't want to see it because it's just not a great environment when there's really strong inflation in place. And when you look at it, whether it was from the 70s or 80s or back at different economies around the world, once it gets in place, it's very difficult to remove inflation. That's why, in general, the Federal Reserve has always been so hawkish on, making sure that if inflation gets above 2%, that they kind of step in and they start raising rates. They kind of change their policy if they see that. But what we've seen a little bit more recently is that with a global economy, there tends to be a little bit less inflation because companies can outsource, whether it be labor or for production of manufacturing parts or whatever. They can do it from a global perspective, right? And we see that with both large corporations, but also for small companies, they can do that. So that tends to keep inflation lower when you can get commodities and different parts manufactured around the world or outsourced labor. It keeps prices lower. But it's just definitely something that we're always looking at as far as where does inflation stand? Because if it were to come back, the Federal Reserve could have to move quicker than they might otherwise, right? They've talked about not raising rates until 2022 at the very end, or even 2023. So that would be very accommodating, but they might have to step up earlier if there was inflation, and that would be not a great thing for the economy or the markets. But it doesn't mean that, it's more one of those things you have to kind of watch very closely from a quarter-to-quarter perspective to see where we stand with that. And here's the big thing too, is inflation expectations, right? So it's not only what is the current inflation rate, But where are people, consumers, expecting it to go? Because when we talk to small business owners, what they say is they're actually able to increase prices, and this is true with corporations, and that's how they can actually, keep their profit margin going up because consumers are expecting inflation, so they're willing to pay more. But the problem, because is if that can be a vicious cycle, right? It can feed into inflation just ramping up. As that higher demand for goods and services, and then what happens is those consumers expect higher wages too, right? So that's where we have to see, what are not only what is inflation, but what are inflation expectations, and if those keep moving up in lockstep, then that's where it becomes problematic. Well, folks, we're going to go to commercial break and come back and join us as we continue the discussion and we take your questions. You're listening to Let's Talk Money on News Radio WGY, 103.1 FM and 810 AM. Welcome back, folks. For those of you just joining us, my name is Martin Shields. I'm a wealth advisor at Boucher Financial Group, and I'm sitting in for my colleague, Steve Boucher, who's taking a well-deserved break. And it's great to be here with you on this gorgeous sunny morning. I hope you're enjoying your cup of coffee or tea. I'm an iced coffee drinker. I never actually drank coffee until I met my now wife, fiance back, it was probably 20 years ago, and she got me drinking Starbucks. So I've started to drink coffee, but now I drink iced coffee all the time. Never drink hot coffee, almost except for the coldest of coldest mornings. The other thing I've started to enjoy a little bit is tea. Now I only have tea, not caffeinated tea, because if I'm gonna have coffee, I don't want to get over caffeinated. But I have tea now. If it's cold out, I'll have hot tea. Right below our offices in Saratoga is Saratoga Honey and Tea, and if you ever have a chance to go there, it is so good. I mean, you don't have to be a tea lover to really enjoy their tea. And they've got the only problem, they've got so many options. It's hard to narrow it down. But they have a honey and ginger tea that is just fantastic, and I have that hot. And then they have like a raspberry, boysenberry, something like that. It's a that I have cold, and again, it is so good. It's just hard to explain how good it is. Now, it's definitely, I think it's probably $4 plus for a cup of tea or whatever it is. But it's not cheap, but it's definitely worth it. And as I've gotten older, I'm definitely a believer in value, right? So it's important to manage cost, but and more importantly, I want to have value for what I'm spending money on. This is what we talk, with our clients. We always talk about what's the value proposition of working with a firm like ours. And without a doubt, for our clients, it's our the investment management, having our firm take care of all those responsibilities and execute on those in up markets or down markets. It's the financial planning component, the fact that we're our client's personal CFO, and it's our client service team. Our clients are never on a 1-800 number with a large financial institution. Even though we use Charles Schwab as our custodian, if they ever need anything done, they're just calling our team, our client service team, to get stuff done. And I will tell you, as an advisor, working with our client service team and with our clients on stuff that needs to get done, it's invaluable. It is when you need stuff done, and especially when you're retiring, or if there's a death in the family or something going on, a life change, with our client service team, it's invaluable. And that's where value proposition comes in. But I'm as a consumer, I'm always trying to be aware of value proposition. And it's easy to get caught up with trying to save a few pennies here and there. And then, what happens is you realize there's a reasoning that maybe that's cheaper, right? That's definitely the case. Is there's nothing for free in this world. And also, usually, if this is not always the case, but usually, if something's a little more expensive, it's probably worth it. And that's where that value proposition comes in, trying to make sure you're getting value for the dollars that you're using. Let's just go ahead and talk about a few financial planning items that you can incorporate in your own personal situation. But again, if you have any questions, feel free to give me a call. You can reach me at 800-810-8010. 800-825-5949. Again, that's 800-825-5949. One of the things I just want to bring up, we talk about this with our clients, is when you're talking about college for your kid or even grandchildren, you know, it's so important these days that you really try to look at it through the lens of a business decision. And listen, you know, as I mentioned beginning of the show, my daughter's going to be a senior at high school in Saratoga and looking at colleges. And it's tough to do that, you know, with a son or daughter at that age, right? They're thinking a little bit differently than this decision as a purely business decision. But you know, there's an element where you really need to do that, given how expensive college is. And you know, when you think about it, that you know, on the high end for these private schools, $75,000-$80,000. Now, granted, the majority of people are getting a discount off of that, but you know, a discount off of $75,000 or $80,000, you know, even if you got half price, you're still paying $40,000. And you know, let's say you go down a little bit, you know, less expensive school that you're, you know, 50 or 60. You know, there's a good chance this is going to cost you $30,000 or $40,000 a year or 20. Like, that's a lot of money to be paying. And the problem, and the real important reason why I bring this up, is so often it's families and children, kids taking on debt to make this work, right? And you know, I just see it so often where you know, families could be foregoing making the right decisions for retirement by going ahead and paying too much for a college they can't afford. And you know, we see this with also with you know, students coming out with too much debt that you know, there's a good chance if you go to undergrad that you're going to want to go to grad school. And you know, so whatever you debt you take on for undergrad, now you're going to take on even more debt for grad school. And you know, it is such a burden to be paying off debt for 5, 10, 15 years after undergrad or grad school. And especially, and this is the most important thing, if you're thinking about going to law school or going to med school, you know, the amount of debt that you could be coming out, you know, with those types of schooling and how long it takes you to pay that off. And here's the other thing that we see too, is that, you know, people get forced into going into jobs where they are making more money, but maybe they're not as satisfied with those jobs. And you really don't want to be, you know, putting yourself or your kid in that situation where, you know, they're really forced to take a job where they're going to get paid more just to pay down the college loans, when really, you know, the goal here is to find something that you want to do and be happy from a career perspective. So, you know, it's what I always say, it's kind of like buying a car, right? You know, if you can't afford from a budget perspective to go out and buy a Porsche or be a part of an expensive country club, then you don't do it, right? You don't, because it's not, you're not going to be able to sustain it for that long. And it's the same thing with college, which is, you know, if it's not in your budget to be going to, you know, a really expensive school, then, you know, it's probably better off looking at maybe community college for 2 years or a state school for 4 years. And that's really the approach that you want to take just to make it just a little bit more affordable and put yourself in a better spot for the future. Really, that's the thing you got to think about when you make those decisions, is not just about right now, but what about the future? Well, folks, we're going to go to commercial break, but come back and join us as we continue the discussion and we take your questions. You listen to Let's Talk Money on News Radio WGY 103.1 FM and 810 AM. Welcome back, folks. For those of you just joining us, my name is Martin Shields, and I'm your host today for Let's Talk Money. I'm sitting here for my colleague, Steve Boucher, and I hope that you're doing well on this gorgeous morning. And I encourage you to call in with any questions you may have regarding your financial planning or investment management concerns, and you can reach me at 800-825-5949. That's 800-825-5949. So last night, my wife and some friends went out for dinner, and afterwards we stopped for a drink on top of the rooftop deck on top of Cantina in Saratoga Springs. And I would highly recommend to anyone who's just really nice atmosphere. They've done a great job. I mean, the restaurant's a great restaurant to begin with, but the rooftop deck just opened up this summer. And it's only for 21 and older. They're only really serving alcohol. There's no food up there, but just a nice setting, not a scene, just really relaxed. They did a great job with the decorating and everything, put a lot of money into it, you could tell. Great service, and just a nice way to end the evening, very kind of away from the hustle and bustle of the street, and would just highly recommend it. So that's the rooftop deck on top of Cantina in Saratoga Springs. Just a great place to go grab a drink and just relax and kind of enjoy the evening, or during the day, it could be nice as well. I think a little bit warmer up there during the day, depending on what time you go. But something I'd put out there for anybody who wants to kind of do something a little bit different and new. And again, they kind of limit how many folks go up there, so it's not too crazy. Just a nice relaxing scene. So let's get back to talking about some financial planning ideas that you can implement in your own personal situation. And again, if you have any questions, you can reach me at 800-825-5949. So one of the things I want to talk about is this concept of a pledged asset line of credit, right? So the way this gets set up is if you have a taxable brokerage account. So I'm not talking about an IRA, Roth, or traditional IRA. I'm talking about a taxable brokerage account that you can actually set it up, whether it be a margin line of credit or a asset backed, just a few differences there, but really the same kind of concept, that you can draw, borrow money against those assets, that investment, and usually anywhere up from 50 to 75% of the value of the account. So just, you know, making things simple, you know, if it's a $1 million account, you can borrow anywhere from $500,000 to $750,000 against that. And, you know, these days, you know, I know with Charles Schwab, with either banks that we utilize through Charles Schwab or through Charles Schwab itself, you know, you can get a rate of anywhere from 2 to 3%, maybe 4% in the high end, maybe a little bit below 2%. And it's just a great way that if you need short-term cash, especially from a real estate perspective, that's where a lot of our clients use it, that you can borrow against those assets. The loan approval process is usually pretty straightforward, right? Because the way these banks or Charles Schwab or any financial custodian looks at it is say, hey, listen, those assets are the collateral, right? So as long as you keep those assets in place, then we're going to let you borrow against it, because if you default on the loan, we're just going to take your assets. So it really, you know, from a loan approval perspective, is a very, fairly quick way to get access to a you know, potentially large line of credit with the pretty cheap rates, relatively speaking. And the great thing about this is that you're not selling your portfolio to access that cash, right? You know, if you, let's say you need some money for a year or two or three or whatever the case may be, you know, you could potentially sell those positions, but you're going to incur capital gains to do that. So really, you know, that's, you know, it's an option, but it's not necessarily the best option, especially if you're looking for, let's say, a large amount of money, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. If you've had those positions for a while and they've done well, you could be talking about a significant capital gain to access that. Or, you know, you can use the brokerage line of credit, pledged asset line, and even like have a margin line to access it. So a great way to, you know, especially to bridge a gap. If, you know, I know sometimes with folks, they're buying a home, but they haven't sold their other home. And so maybe the bank won't approve them for a mortgage at that point. So, you know, again, this is a great way to kind of bridge a situation with some cash. You can do it more long term. You know, it's sometimes some of these brokerage and financial institutions are not inclined to, they're probably not going to give you a 30-year or a 15-year fixed rate. They might do a 5 or 10-year fixed rate. So, you know, it's going to be a little bit more shorter term than an actual mortgage. But again, just a great thing to consider rather than, you know, potentially selling those investments and incurring capital gains to access it, and something that we utilize with our clients quite a bit in that respect. Again, folks, if you have any questions, give me a call. You can reach me at 800-825-5949. One of the other things I want to talk about is with a 401k plan, many people are fortunate enough to have what's called a safe harbor contribution from their employer, or a profit sharing contribution. And what that is, you know, as an employee, you can put up to 19,500 into a 401k plan right now on an annual basis. And if you're 50 and older, you can put another 6,500, so you get total of 26,000 that you can put into a 401k plan, right? But on top of that, in our firm is like this, we have a great retirement plan, a lot of great benefits at Boucher Financial Group, but we have a a safe harbor contribution, which safe harbor basically just allows a 401k plan not to do as much testing. And it can either be what's called non-elective, where you just, everybody gets that money, whether they put anything in, or it can be a match. But that's a nice addition, you know, that the employer can put in. But then there's also the profit sharing component, which is when the employer puts in additional money into a 401k plan. And, you know, they could put between the employee amount and the employer amount, you could be talking anywhere from around $58,000 up to $64,000. That's the maximum amount that can be put in between the employee and the employer. And what I want to bring up is if you are fortunate enough to have a 401k and you're able to put it in, you know, a good amount of money on your own, and that you have the employer contribution safe harbor, in particular if it's a profit sharing component. So what that would mean is at that point they're going to be, you know, putting in a decent amount of money in on your behalf. What I'm going to suggest to you is really making sure that probably your a decent amount, let's say at least half of your employee contribution into the 401k plan should be a Roth contribution versus a pre-tax. Now, not all plans have the Roth option, right? Which is, you know, the standard 401k contribution is the pre-tax. So you don't pay any taxes on it, you put it in, grows tax deferred until you take it out in retirement, in which case you pay ordinary income tax on it. The Roth is, there's no income phase outs like there is with a Roth IRA, but the Roth is great. You put in it post-tax, it grows tax-free forever. And right now there are no RMDs, require minimum distributions, like there are with a traditional IRA or traditional 401k. So that money can grow tax-free forever. And the reason I would suggest at least putting in half into a Roth, almost regardless of your income level, you know, usually is the case is when you're in the lower income levels, if you're in, let's say, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 or under $100,000, you definitely want to probably be utilizing the Roth component, especially if you're early in your career, because, you know, you're going to be in a higher tax bracket later in your career, and you're going to be better off putting away some pre-tax dollars. But, you know, even if you're in a higher tax bracket, I would still recommend putting, let's say, half into a Roth, because the thing you have to remember is all those employer contributions, pretty much, there's a few exceptions here and there, but pretty much all those employer contributions have to be made with pre-tax dollars, right? So you think about it. So your safe harbor, your profit sharing, which, as I mentioned, can go up to, you know, total contributions with your employee amount up to $58,000 or $64,000 with the catch-up amount, that's a lot of dollars that are going to be pre-tax. So, you know, having some dollars that are post-tax in the Roth is going to be very important, because what we see occasionally is people have just too many dollars in a traditional IRA, so that when they're required to take them out when they're 72, it becomes an awful lot of income, and it actually impacts their Medicare premiums. And, you know, they're not expecting that. Now, this is a good thing, right? I'm not, you know, having a lot of dollars in an IRA is a good thing. But just like with investing, diversifying from a tax perspective is also a good thing. And there is nothing better from a financial planning perspective when we see a client with a lot of dollars in a Roth IRA. It is just a great thing for that individual, because now when they take those dollars out, no taxes on it, right? If you have $500,000 in a traditional IRA, well, every dollar that you take out, you're going to be paying ordinary income on that distribution. If you have $500,000 on a Roth IRA, no tax on that distribution. It's just a great situation. So, you know, we're always big fans of Roth IRAs in general, but, you know, many people get phased out from contributing to a Roth IRA. Whereas, you know, with the Roth 401k, no income phase outs. You know, you can put up that, you know, you can put up to $26,000 if you're 50 and older into the Roth. And in particular, as I mentioned, if you have the safe harbor or the profit sharing, that those dollars are going to be pre-tax. So diversifying how you're contributing, probably a good thing, something to consider at least. We're going to go to the phone lines. We have Mike from Troy. Mike, you there?
Yes, sir. How are we doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I got a question about the Chinese market. I see the
Okay.
ETF KWEB is down over 50%, and with everything going on with the regulators and all that, do you think these Chinese stocks could start hitting a bottom and coming back here?
Yeah, it's great point. So, they really spiked in 2020 and 2000 and early 2021, and they've come back really hard. And as you mentioned, just so the listeners know, really what happened is the government, Chinese government, kind of cracked, really stepped up surveillance of them and in different elements of policing what they're doing. And that has taken a huge hit on those stocks. Here's the thing is China, from an economic perspective, is just a dynamo, right? So it's going to do well. These companies are probably going to do well. The problem, it shows you what the issues are with China from an investment perspective, right? Which is when the government can do what they're doing to these publicly traded companies, it can change what it means to be an investor in those. So, I would say probably over time, it's a safe bet, right? They've come way down off their highs. Like you mentioned, they're probably 50% below where the highs are. They're still trading, if you look over the last, 5 years, they're still trading in that range they were in back all the way down to 2016. But it's not a bad investment, right? It's definitely, you're going to get some pretty good value for your dollars there. The only question is, does this continue to happen with the Chinese government? And does it impact the way these companies can operate? And that's the risk that you take by investing overseas, in particular in China, where you don't have the same sort of laws and regulations that you have here in the US. But that risk can be a huge upside. So I don't think it's a bad idea to kind of getting some exposure to it, just realizing that you got more uncertainty there as far from a government perspective.
Okay, I appreciate your thought there. I see Europe come out of recession. I know China sells a lot of products to Europe too, so I just keep hoping it's going to start turning around here soon for a little bit.
Yeah, you're talking about from China's perspective. As far as, again, here's the other thing is I always say you don't bet against the US economy, but at the same time, like I think the Chinese economy is going to do really well. And it's just challenging from a public investment perspective of the risk that exists with the Chinese government. But I think it's probably worthwhile putting some money in there, understanding that it's a risky investment, right? Just got to appreciate that. But there's a good chance that the Chinese government is not too foolish either. They don't want to squash investment in their company. So I think they may relent a little bit. So it's probably not a bad time to put some money in, and it may kind of return to some of the highs that you saw earlier this year.
Okay, thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate it.
All right, you take care. Enjoy your day. So yeah, great question from Mike. That is I tell you, we talk about the issues that exist here in the US, and again, regulatory, go down to the list, there are issues. But when you start looking at our country from an economic perspective and from an investment perspective versus any other country, I mean, it doesn't matter really what the other country is. It doesn't get much better than here in the US. And you may be frustrated with taxes or whatever, put that could go down the list of things you're frustrated with, but you compare it to other countries and they have their issues as well. So at least here in the US, there's less issues. I'm not saying zero, but less issues with government regulating businesses and government stepping in. And it can happen. I mean, we talked about this with the FANG stocks. One of the issues that exists with the FANG stocks is that the government could decide to crack down and regulate on them and what they're how they're operating. And it could some of it could be legit, right? If they're creating monopolistic environments where other companies can't thrive, that's not good for the economy or consumers or whatever, right? So that there is times where it is important for the government to step in. You know, I, as an economist, you know, I'm a capitalist. I believe in the idea that, you know, capital will flow to the ideas where it's best. But with that said, you know, if you let, you know, a capitalistic environment go without any regulations, the changes that can occur are usually not in a manner that most people are comfortable with. And they always line up well with the democracy. And, you know, that's the thing in China. It's not a democracy, so they can do what they want. The advantage of that is with a centralized economy like and government like they have, you know, they can really put capital to areas like infrastructure, like they've done, you know, in a very effective manner. The downside with that is, you know, things like free speech and, you know, being able to run a company without the government really kind of tracking everything that's going on is limited. And that impacts you from an investment perspective as well. So a great question from Mike there. But I want to just move on to a couple other financial planning things to consider before we are up with our hour. But again, if you have any questions, you can reach me at 800-825-5949. That's 800-825-5949. One of the things I want to talk about is for individuals out there that are working for a publicly traded company where you have either restricted stock, you have stock options, or you have an employee stock purchase plan, ESPP. You know, we have a lot of clients that have either one, two, or three of these options. They're just all ways to get exposure to your company stock. And, you know, I always say, having worked in the 90s in telecom in DC, you know, if you have a situation where, you know, you have company stock and it's done well, and there's definitely a number of local companies and national companies where that this is the case, you know, having exposure to them is fantastic. I mean, that is awesome. If you've got restricted stock and it's doing well, you got stock options and they're in the money, or if you've got employee stock purchase plan and that your stock has done well, it's fantastic. But the thing is with that is you really need to have a plan in place to be diversifying out of that over time, right? You know, because the thing you have to remember is, as quickly as, let's say, a company stock goes up and you're loving it because now you have all this money in your company stock through these different programs, it can go the other way real quickly. And you really don't want to be in a situation where you've got so much exposure to a particular company. You work in that company as well. So, right, your job, your career path is all tied up in that. And then something happens. Something in the industry happens. There's something that happens from a mismanagement perspective. And that company stock goes down. And now maybe your job's in jeopardy. You know, there's a lot of things that can happen. So, you know, the one thing I would tell you, and this is where we work with our clients, is to put a plan in place to slowly sell positions if the company stock is doing well, right? Don't get too greedy in just trying to either time it and or, you know, just thinking that it's never going to go down or there's going to be volatility in it. Don't be afraid to take some gains in those positions, but do it in a systematic fashion, right? Actually, you know, just make sure that you're kind of selling very slow and steady. And there's a plan that exists out there, especially for executives that are limited by times they can trade. It's called 10b5-1 plans. Okay, again, that's 10b5-1 plans. Now, many employees are not restricted when they can sell. They can sell whenever they want. And again, the only thing I would suggest to you is still having a plan that you understand, you know, kind of systematically selling and doing it in a way that is most tax efficient. And that's where we spend a lot of time with our clients, right? Because depending on whether it's an employee stock purchase plan, restricted stock, or stock options, there's a whole slew of different tax things you need to be aware of with that. So either working with an advisor or your tax preparer with this. But having if you are an executive or an individual that is restricted on when you can sell those shares, having a 10b5-1 plan, which basically says you're going to sell certain shares at certain prices over a certain period of time. And this allows you to sell and not have to worry about the trading windows that exist if you're an executive. So again, I would encourage you to set that up. You know, you're gonna have to know the nuances that exist with your particular plan. So again, working with an advisor on this, it's gonna make your life a lot easier, but having a plan in place and not thinking that you're smarter than the market. I mean, it really is, especially when you work for the company, you know, it's easy to drink the Kool-Aid and think that it's only going to go up and, you know, you'd never want to sell. But I can tell you so many different times where clients wish they had sold, or people wish they had sold at least a little bit, right? Just don't be afraid to take some gains in those positions, and don't be too greedy, you know, when it's doing well and you made some money with that. Again, because you have so much tied up into it, you don't want to be in a situation where, you know, things change and, you know, your job's in jeopardy and all that money you had in stock options is no longer there. Well, folks, it's been a great hour being with you. Hopefully you learned a lot. You have some ideas to take home with yourself. You're listening to Let's Talk Money on News Radio WGY, 103.1 FM, 810 AM. Folks, take care of yourself and take care of each other and have a great day. We'll see you next weekend.